Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the rise of the maker movement in recent years, more and more people are getting their hands dirty with projects of all kinds. We see the proof on websites like Etsy, where you can find and buy a staggering variety of handmade and artisanal products. While the appeal of the maker movement is to learn a skill and make some really cool stuff, our guest Peter Korn says the real benefit is not the stuff you make, but the time spent making it. Peter Korn's new book is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. In addition to being an author, he is a master furniture maker and founder and executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship in Rockport, Maine. Peter Korn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Virginia, pleasure to be here.
So you admit that woodworking is a pretty marginal field in many ways, but the book is part of the story of your evolution into that field. Let's begin with how you kind of fell into it.
Okay, well, I had never worked with my hands all the way through college, and I also always felt in college like I was living life secondhand somehow, although I didn't know how. But I certainly was looking for real life when I finished. And in 1972, I moved to Nantucket Island, which was a really empty, quiet place at the time. And the first job that came along was as a carpenter. So much to my father's horror, I took a job as a carpenter because he wanted me to be a lawyer or something equivalent. And I found I was horrible at being a carpenter at first, of course. But as soon as I got the hang of it, I found that I loved it. And it was a lot more intellectually engaging as well as physically engaging than anything I'd been led to expect.
So within a year, your fingers start getting muscly. You buy a Ford truck.
All those things. young hippie carpenter with a dog, yeah, and a beard. I became a furniture maker because after 2 years as a carpenter, I made a cradle for some friends. And it was really a trial and error way of making a cradle. I didn't know anything about joinery or fine furniture making. But as soon as I was done it, I quit my carpentry job and dedicated myself to figuring out how to make furniture. Mm-hmm. And really all I was thinking about was the how of it, trying to rediscover how do you sharpen a chisel, how do you use a hand plane, how do you cut a dovetail. And I designed each new piece only so that I could incorporate a new technique in it I wanted to learn.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't thinking about design.
Right.
But after 5 or 10 years of that, I started to get really interested in design and realized that that was even more interesting than making things. Mm. So I went from sort of the how of things to thinking about design, and then after some period of time, I started wondering about the why of it.
You're hitting on something that I really enjoyed about reading this is, first of all, there is a photograph of that cradle among many other projects that you have undertaken through the years. But, you know, creative people can't always articulate the process of making things, and a lot of the book is actually about that. And there's this kind of realization of your aesthetic goals as a furniture maker beginning to align with the person you want to be. And I'm just wondering if that is something that arrived upon you, or is this just a gradual process?
It's a gradual process of growing up and broadening my perspective. Really, I read letters that I wrote when I was in my carpenter in my 20s. You know, I don't like that person very much, actually. That was a really self-absorbed young man. And so it's been a long, slow process.
The ego is a big part of making for a lot of people. And that's something that you write about. The motivation for making is not a quest for fame or money or even self-expression. Then what is it?
I think it's a process of self-discovery. And I honestly think that the single thing that we all do that defines our humanity is we spend our lives making up and maintaining our own story of who we are and how the world works. And I think that creative work in general is a great way to extend and explore that. And for me, especially in the early days, becoming a furniture maker was a way of building a person.
Mm. But I think a lot of people heading into the studio or the kitchen or the garden, they have this idea of the goal. This is what I want to come out with. This is me expressing myself.
If you went into the studio knowing what you were going to end up with, you wouldn't even walk in the door. The fact is, the creative work is always a process of discovery where you don't know what you're going to come out with, and that's what makes a creative work, and that's what makes it engaging. The primary reason why I got involved in furniture making and practice it really was as a process of self-transformation, discovery in the studio. I really do think that's why every creative person I've ever met does the work. The world doesn't really need another mug or symphony or novel, does it? I mean, it's got plenty of them. It's not pounding on our doors asking for them. We do it because it's an internal drive that gets us to do it.
Peter Korn is with us. He's written a new book. It's kind of part memoir, part meditation, and called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. We're living in this moment of reviving craft, you know, the makers movement. Shop Classes Soulcraft was a big bestseller. Slow food. This happened after the Industrial Revolution and other times like the 1970s when you got started. Is this something that we're just going to see cycle around every few decades, or is it here to stay? What do you think?
I think that the urge to build things is biologically intrinsic to human beings. We've been making things to further our survivals through millions of years of evolution. So I'm convinced that we just want and need and get satisfaction out of handling natural materials and making things with them. I have no question about that. And I'm delighted about the maker movement. And these are young people who feel a need to rediscover how to make and rediscover the world for themselves, just like I and my generation did 40 years ago. So I think it is cyclical, but I think there will be people hungrier and hungrier for it. And when they discover it, their passion will light up.
That is very interesting to consider, because I think of the woodworker, you know, the lone craftsperson. It's a very solitary scene for me. But you talk about it as a sort of a way of connecting with society. How do you merge those
two things? First of all, it was very solitary for the people in the studio craft movement, by and large. Our ideal was to have a little shop behind the house and go back and bury ourselves in it. And I like to say that studio craft, if I had to explain what it is, we confused virtuosity with virtue. We tried really hard to get good at it and to make things that could only come from our own hands and our own mind. And when I see the makers movement today, or when I see something I'm excited about, which is sort of what I'll call the studio product design movement that's centered in Brooklyn but is all over the country, where young people, they are designing things without that isolation. They're designing and making things, and then they're making them for production by other people. I find that a different outlook that's really exciting.
Technology is being used a lot in making furniture. I'm thinking of places like IKEA and West Elm, you know, making very inexpensive furniture. And locally, this is one of the more common criticism against the artisanal movement, that goods are just too expensive for regular people to buy. And I'm wondering about your thoughts on that.
I've been talking about my book to groups around the country. And one thing that comes up often, and this is important to me, is that in mainstream culture that we live in, the only yardsticks we seem to be provided with for measuring the value of what we do are money and fame. How much does it sell for? How famous is the artist? Or how much, you know, attention does the thing we make get? And those are really poor yardsticks for measuring the value of creative work to a person or a life or society. So one of the things I'm hoping about the book is it will contribute to a conversation about what our other yardsticks should be for valuing creative work. And I think one of the mistakes we make as creative people, as artists, as craftspeople, is buying into this money and fame idea, so that we think that we're only valid at it, or only makes a difference for us if we're actually selling things and making our living at it. And from my point of view, it is just as valuable if you're doing it as an avocation, as a hobby. It doesn't have to be a profession, your creative work. The bottom line for me is this: having written the book, I learned a lot. And what I've discovered is my bottom line is that the sort of meaning and fulfillment that we all seem so hungry for doesn't have to be found in craft. It doesn't have to be found in art. But where it lies is in the hard work of having an idea and then translating it into the physical world in a way that matters and makes a difference. It could be an idea for a table. It could be an idea for a painting. But it could be an idea for a new business. It could be an idea in the science laboratory you're exploring. It's exercising our creative muscle that is where we inhabit our humanity to the fullest.
Peter Korn, thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
Peter Korn is founder and executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship in Rockport, Maine. His new book is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. While Peter Korn and others were heading back to the land in the 60s and 70s, bowling was in its heyday, with highly paid pros and huge audiences. So what happened? Bowling alone, when word of mouth continues, in just a moment.
From the Firestone Bowlerama, it's the World Series of Championship Bowling. As usual, Mr. Bill Bonetta. Bill, I know you have a word here about these two fellas.
Harry Tiger Smith, his nickname describes him perfectly. He's quite a tiger with the ball. Of course, Nelson Burton Jr. is quite a young, lion-hearted bowler. And I'm going to put this affectionately. They're both animals with that bowling ball. No matter how you look at it, it should be prove to be an interesting match.
Sound there from CBS's Championship Bowling, a widely popular show on what was then a tremendously popular sport. The 60s and 70s are considered the golden years of pro bowling in the U.S., with top bowlers making millions of dollars, more money than the big-name NFL and MLB players were making at the time combined. Bowlers were celebrities with endorsement deals and model girlfriends. The name Harry Smith and Nelson Burton Jr. were tantamount to a Tom Brady or a Tiger Woods today. So what happened to pro bowling? Can you name a pro bowler today? Certainly not making as much as NFL stars. And here to give us more on the story is Zachary Crockett. He wrote The Rise and Fall of Professional Bowling for Priceonomics.com. Zach, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
Give us a little, please, history on bowling itself. Where did it start?
Sure. Well, the origins of bowling can be traced back to the 11th century. It actually started as a religious ritual in which participants would roll these giant stones toward these pins to absolve their sins. And by the 1300s, bowling had become so popular in England, it had kind of evolved at this point, and it kind of became linked with the middle class. King Henry VIII had to actually ban it in the 1500s because it was distracting them too much from their jobs. During the 1800s, it was kind of introduced to the United States. And the first alleys in the U.S. were these dingy, very crowded, smoke-filled rooms that were mainly men, and it was kind of closely tied with drinking as well.
I understand that when the game made its way to the U.S., it took some time to catch on because of problems with the law and lack of regulations. What was going on?
Yeah, well, in kind of the early days in New York when these alleys were introduced, some entrepreneurs, let's say, kind of saw the gambling potential in the game. And so the game became very associated with gambling and racketeering. Actually, so much so that nine-pin bowling was banned in several states. And in order to circumvent this law, a bunch of bowlers teamed together and invented 10-pin bowling. So kind of that became the modern-day sport.
That is so funny. A great workaround. So what then propelled bowling into a major profitable sport in the later 20th century?
Right. Well, you know, it was a few things. And I think the main thing was the creation of the Professional Bowling Association in 1958. That's the PBA. By 1963, there were 65 professional bowlers in this organized league. Their average salary was quite high. The league was very popular. It got a lot of media attention. It was always on TV. There were only three channels back then.
How high are we talking?
Well, we're talking basically, the average of these 65 bowlers. We're talking the average salary was $75,000 a year. 25% of them made over $225,000 a year. In 1963, the top bowler, Harry Smith, made more than baseball's MVP and football's MVP combined. And by 1964, Don Carter was the first athlete of any sport to sign a $1 million endorsement deal. So these guys were really rock stars of the era. They were making far much more than other athletes in other sports.
Making a lot of money, but the sport's still relatively new. Were these guys as good as the bowlers are today?
Yes, they were pretty incredible. We're talking 250, 260 averages. But one distinction to make is that bowling has gotten a lot easier today. A lot of the bowlers I talk to, they say that lanes are slicker, balls are more dynamic, and, it's a lot easier to bowl a perfect game today. So in a lot of ways, a lot of the bowlers I talked to were very nostalgic about the old days. They said that, lanes were slower and it was definitely harder to bowl a perfect game.
So life was pretty good for the pros, it sounds like. What about regular everyday people? Was bowling a popular recreational sport in the U.S. at the time?
It was. Bowling kind of also experienced a recreational renaissance during the 1960s. The U.S. Bowling Congress, which is kind of a governing body of bowling, peaked at its membership of 4.6 million members. And, it was kind of the thing to do on the weekends. Families would go out, and it was kind of a working class kind of recreational activity.
There was something also called action bowling. Can you tell us about what that is?
Sure. Action bowling is really interesting. That was kind of a movement that sparked up in the 50s and 60s in New York. And these working class Italians from New York City's boroughs would kind of congregate at these alleys after hours. And they would bowl late into the morning, making these bets. So it would kind of draw an amalgam of all these shady characters from the city into this space. And I think action bowling can kind of be told through the story of Iggy Russo. Late one night, Iggy Russo had fixed a match to lose. And it came down to the final frame, and he could either make the spare and win or miss the spare and lose. And he learned midway through that some unsavory characters were betting on him to lose, or to win, rather. So if he won, his money lender would kill him. And if he lost, these mafia members would kill him. So he faked a heart attack to just get out of the whole ordeal. And, these are the kind of characters that were part of the action bowling scene in New York in the 1960s.
We get to the 1980s and bowling starts to fizzle out. What happened?
It was partly mismanagement. It was mostly poor marketing on the part of the PBA. Other sports like the NFL and the MLB really adjusted well to expanding networks, and they marketed their players. The PBA really faltered in those areas. So it was partly the rise of media. We went from having three television stations in the 1970s to having hundreds by the 90s. So I think bowling got buried a little bit. It didn't adapt. Another thing, as I mentioned, is bowling got easier as a sport. There are over 35,000 perfect games bowled every season today. And back in the 60s, there were only 800 or 900 a season.
Zachary Crockett wrote The Rise and Fall of Professional Bowling for Priceonomics.com. You'll find a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. If performance bowling is your goal, it's essential that the lane is spotless and well-regulated. Tim Eaton is certified by the United States Bowling Congress to inspect bowling lanes. He tells the story of the strangest thing he ever found inspecting a lane behind the pins at his home alley in Falmouth, Massachusetts.
When I'm certifying a lane, I'm going to knock all the pins out of here. Pins are gone. Okay. Crawl into here with me. We've got the power shut off, and we're underneath the machine. We're laying on what's called the pin deck.
Now, as a certified USBC lane inspector, the good thing is that if back down.
I question something, I have the right to walk across the foul line, go down, and check it out. So it's good because I get to see how the other houses or bowling alleys maintain their equipment. There's some pretty bad bowling alleys out there. I would look behind this one bowling alley down where the machines are. The dirt and dust had blown in from the back door, got on the machine, and had not been cleaned, and there was actually grass growing on top of the pin setter. That's probably the weirdest thing I've ever seen, and I was a little shocked.
And our thanks to producer Andrew Norton for that piece. Back in 1972, McDonald's added the Egg McMuffin to its menu and has ever since dominated the fast food breakfast market. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to look at the newest kid on the breakfast block, Taco Bell's Waffle Taco.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In recent years, foodies have championed the value of eating local, seasonal foods. Right now, that means fiddleheads and mushrooms, and pretty soon, rhubarb, radishes, and a variety of spring herbs. But far from the fresh gardens and farmers markets that we hold so dear, a very different kind of food is getting a lot of attention. It's the star of fast food chain Taco Bell's new breakfast menu, the Waffle Taco.
I have to say, I'm a little disappointed. It's kind of spongy.
Yeah, that's exactly the word I was about to use. You know, when I have a waffle, I toast it. And this tastes like an untoasted waffle. But more than that, it also, maybe it's not stale, but you're right, spongy. It's like not quite the right texture for a waffle.
The Concord Monitor's Clay Wirestone and Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby there, who, for the sake of posterity and deep investigative journalism, reviewed Taco Bell's new breakfast lineup. And while the experiment is funny, is it food snobbery, or do products from fast food chains also deserve critical culinary reviews? And what forces are behind the extreme foods trend? Clay and Taylor join me now to explore some of those very questions. Hello, Clay. Hello, Taylor.
Hello.
How you doing?
Great to see you guys. Thank you very much for taking the hit for us and going and trying the waffle. Now, for those of you who haven't tried it, Clay, could you describe Taco Bell's Waffle Taco and anything that you'd like to add to your too spongy review?
It is a very spongy kind of soft waffle that is then bent up into the taco shape. There's a large sausage patty and some kind of congealed egg bits with cheese inside. But what I found actually most surprising about it was you have this thing that looks strange. It sounds strange. People react in such an over-the-top way of thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe that this thing is out. But then you actually eat it and it's rather bland, really.
Okay, so it doesn't live up to all of the hype.
Well, you would I don't know. I think a lot of times when people hear about this kind of extreme food, you expect an extreme taste, and certainly in this case, that wasn't really my experience.
And yet, you know, you have to also think. You know, I think I was initially, when I just saw advertisements for it, sort of repulsed by the idea of the waffle taco. That being said, it's really all just breakfast food that you would eat on the same plate. And I think if I had thought of it at home and made this by myself, I think it would have been a stroke of genius on my part. I would have been so proud of my creation. And yet when, you know, Taco Bell does it, you know, we sort of see it as this, oh my goodness, it's so extravagant, it's so indulgent. And we're all sort of fascinated by, you know, what does this Frankenstein food taste like?
NPR's blog Sandwich Mondays reviewed it last week, calling it a little meat canoe, which really divided people. The sampling of the comments, is this NPR or The Onion? Really, NPR, this is news, seems more like free corporate advertising to me. Another, my favorite, stay classy, NPR. Then on the other side, we had stop being elitist, people. The writing is entertaining and no one is forcing you to eat this stuff. Go, NPR. I'd love to hear what you guys think. All good fun or elitist?
Well, I mean, I was really thinking about this a lot since we did this, and I feel like food is rapidly becoming a topic kind of like, you know, politics or religion, where there are these – people have huge ideological divides about it. People feel very passionately, you know, kind of in one camp or the other, you know, keep your big government hands off of my food, or, you know, why are big corporations trying to make us eat all this stuff? And to me at least, I see it as, you know, it's all – food. It's all, you know, theoretically food. You know, what's the harm in trying something? And, you know, moderation in all things, especially moderation.
Yeah. I mean, in defense of NPR, I've got to say, you know, the Sandwich Monday's blog is written by a couple of the writers from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And it actually says on the page, this is satire. So I think a lot of the people that commented on that blog post may not have actually read the article, or just, you know, like you often hear comments on All Things Considered, how come you're considering these sorts of things? Well, the show is called All Things Considered.
Plus, it does look kind of like a meat canoe. I mean, it's not an inaccurate description.
Clay, you've reviewed other fast food creations for The Monitor. So what do you think the fascination is first?
I mean, I think the fascination is largely conceptual, which is you come up with an idea, and I mean, and I'm sure this is why the companies do it. The classic example being the quote-unquote double down that KFC had a few years ago, which was a sandwich that was just made of meat.
no buns, just
right,
meat?
There was no bun. There was a patty of chicken, and then another patty of chicken, and then there was some bacon and sauce in the middle. You know, and so – and again, it was kind of like the waffle taco. There were, you know, the New York Times like sent out a food critic to try to get an early take on the double down. And what's funny is that when you actually got it in front of you, it was a couple of pieces of chicken meat with bacon and sauce in the middle. I mean, it was not really worth everyone having heart attacks over, although that maybe would come later.
Maybe the result.
You know, this makes me think of movie reviews, which is to say that there are movies that we can pretty much count on being reviled by critics, but also seen by more people than most other movies. You know, some of these big summer blockbusters are often, you know, they have like 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, but they make millions and millions of dollars. Yet we wouldn't criticize anybody for going out and reviewing one of those films, would we?
Mm-hmm. No, good, really good point. That's Taylor Quimby, producer for Word of Mouth, and Clay Wirestone, who were our taste testers of sorts for some interesting new food offerings, mostly from fast food chains, which I'm noticing more and more roll out these kind of special foods, either in a seasonal way. I mean, we used to always get the Shamrock Shake, right, during the St. Patrick's Day season. What do you think is behind that, this kind of seasonal food idea? Is it just an opportunity to make
Well,
it,
I mean,
make
we're talking
noise?
About it now, so I think that's part of the reason. It's, you know, every time I mean, I think for so long, certainly when I was a kid, you know, you had the notion that it was pretty much always the same. McDonald's would always have the same things, or Burger King would always have the same, you know, what name your chain. And it was always very simple. Mm. And so this notion somehow that, you know, kind of by the seasons you get something different, or especially something that makes people talk, you know, that just gets people talking about your brand and about what your interest, you know, what your business is.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it goes without saying that something like the waffle taco, they've got to know that that's kind of outrageous, and that maybe it's a bit of a wink to all the customers that, you know, aren't forced to go to McDonald's because of circumstance, but choose to, you know, go to McDonald's or Wendy's every now and again. You know, this is the sort of thing that people just can't help but want to see or taste for themselves out of the sheer ridiculousness of it.
And there's also an actual business reason for it, too, which is that in the business of fast food, McDonald's has had the breakfast kind of market all to itself literally for decades. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and people who don't actually otherwise eat fast food will go and get an Egg McMuffin or a coffee. And so that's a real clear business opportunity, because fast food, for all sorts of reasons, including price and recession and all that, has been an industry segment that has not been growing in quite the same way over the last 4 or 5 years.
Coffee, however, has, and that's one of the things you mentioned. Dunkin' Donuts, which has proliferated across the U.S. in the last 5 years, has its own seasonal rollout, ice cream-flavored coffee. Whatever that is. So let's take – you guys did try it, though. Let's listen.
Wow. That's sweet.
I
mean, this just kind of tastes like the culotta.
Well, how different can you make – there's actually a sugar grit in my teeth from this Jamocha almond stuff. Mm. Well, you see here, though, with this, there's actually like a little –
you know, like the little
like a
fudge,
ring of fudge at the bottom,
fudge
yeah.
layer or something at the bottom, which is either really good or really bad.
Okay, should we switch?
Yeah, let's.
Wow. Oh, my goodness, this one.
Boy, there's grit in this one, too.
This just tastes like chocolate syrup.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well.
Ice cream flavored coffee. Which flavor ice cream flavored coffee?
Oh, what was it?
Well, one of them, Taylor had
cookie dough.
Cookie dough, right. And I had Jamocha something.
Wow, that's a lot
Jamocha
going
almond.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jamocha almond chocolate?
I don't know.
I remember I couldn't keep track of them. There was too much to each name.
Yeah. It was just disturbing.
Why, Clay?
I like coffee a lot, but the syrup and added sugar in the coffee really turned me off.
Yeah, I'm more of a coffee snob than I am other types of foods and beverages, and so I think this was not my favorite beverage. I mean, Dunkin' Donuts is Dunkin' Donuts, and I've gotten plenty of coffees there. They all taste like a lot of cream and a lot of sugar. And this was sort of the same thing. And I guess it tasted a little bit like ice cream, but, you know, that's not something that I really am interested in. So, I mean, it was an odd beverage.
So I want to make sure that we cover a lot of different bases. We're not picking on fast food necessarily. Ben and Jerry's, Vermont made by hippies, great friends of NPR, sweaty balls, as we all know. Ben and Jerry's has a new Coors kind of flavor line of ice creams. First, who wants to explain it?
Well, I'll go for this one. So okay. The Coors, there's a variety of different flavors, but it's basically two varieties of ice cream separated on either side of the pint cart that you get when you get a Ben & Jerry's pint. And through the center of it is a core of some other filler type substance. So in one case, goo, yes. In one case, it's pure caramel, a core of pure caramel. One case, I think it's fudge.
Mm-hmm.
We tried one that was, let's see, what was it? It was chocolate ice cream.
Yeah, and there was chocolate ice cream on one side, a raspberry ice cream with chocolate chips on the other side, and then like a raspberry jam
core. But it was basically just raspberry jam through the whole center of this pint of ice cream.
Well, let's hear the taste test.
Raspberry.
It's raspberry core.
It doesn't even say that it's raspberry jam. It just says raspberry.
This one does not look good.
It is very off-center. I'll say that.
I mean, what's funny is there's a picture of what it should look like on the top. This doesn't even look like the right ice cream.
Well, I guess we'll all be surprised.
Jeez. Oh.
Oh, that is weird.
That's basically just like a spoonful of raspberry jam and ice cream.
But why is the raspberry jam in my ice cream? That's what I want to know.
That was it.
I guess nobody can really answer that question, can
they?
The
funny thing about these taste tests is when you think about it, you know, you go to a fine restaurant and somebody talks about the, you know, the chocolatey notes of their wine or sort of the subtlety of whatever meal they're having. There's nothing here to really bank on when it comes to subtlety. This was raspberry jam and chocolate ice cream.
It was not bad. It was really not bad.
And like you sort of talk about a lot of these being a sort of a letdown because they seem strange or extreme, but then they're just flavors that you've had before or mixed together or mushed together. This was kind of a different taste to me.
Right. Well, TV food networks are running shows that celebrate these indulgent foods, you know, man versus food, diners, drive-ins and dives. Do you think the waffle taco, the Coors, the ice cream flavored iced coffee are a kind of extension of this indulgence trend? You know, you're trying something that's kind of bold.
Yeah, I do. I mean, so I used to live in Santa Cruz, California, and on the boardwalk there is this legendary stand, and it is a deep fried Twinkie stand. And they proudly display the fact that each of these deep fried Twinkies has 1,000 calories. And they give you a little cup of strawberry syrup that you're supposed to dip your deep fried Twinkie in. And people love this thing. I mean, it's really famous at that boardwalk. I can't entirely explain it except to say that we are fascinated and love our sugar and our fat and our salt.
I mean, I think part of it too is just like I was saying, the notion that this somehow becomes almost a religious thing for some people. You have a dogma, you have a widely accepted way that we know that we're supposed to eat and the way that we're supposed to live, but you know, everyone loves to sin. I mean, we love to find that you know, back alley or something where we can go and do something unspeakable. And I guess today the unspeakable thing is the Twinkie with strawberry syrup.
It's fast food Mardi Gras.
Taylor Quimby, thank you so much for going out there and taking the hit.
Oh, it really was my pleasure.
Taylor Quimby, he's a producer here at Word of Mouth, and Clay Wirestone, arts editor at the Concord Monitor. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Taylor and Clay are together a couple of extreme food guinea pigs. You can see pictures of their culinary adventures at wordofmouthradio.org. Sorry, hipster dudes. According to researchers at the University of New South Wales, we may be approaching peak beard levels. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to look back at the surprising story behind one of the most famous beards in American history.
Oftentimes, this decision to grow whiskers has been described as an attempt to make Lincoln look older, to possess a certain kind of gravitas that perhaps he was lacking without the whiskers. My interpretation is that, in fact, this was an effort to make him look more urbane and sort of cast off this image of the frontier rail splitter.
Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. According to the New York Times' Adam Goodhart, Abraham Lincoln's beard was certainly the most famous beard in the history of the world. You would think that a beard with such prestige would inspire copycats in the political world. Not so. There has not been a bearded president since William Howard Taft, not even a nominee with a beard since 1916. The story of how Lincoln's whiskers came to be has its own share of drama. It was the first and only time that a president-elect radically changed appearances between his election and his inauguration. And the reason for the change might be the most interesting part. An 11-year-old girl is responsible for advising candidate Lincoln to lose the clean-shaven look. Here with the story is Sean Trainer. He's a PhD candidate in history and women's studies at Penn State University. His article, "The Beard That Wasn't, Abe Lincoln's Whiskers," appeared on the appendix.net. Sean, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Sean, tell us about this letter that Lincoln received that would forever change his look.
So in October of 1860, shortly before the presidential election of that year, Abraham Lincoln, who was, of course, the Republican nominee for president, received a letter from an 11-year-old girl, Grace Bedell of Westfield, New York. And in the letter, she advised him not only that she thought that he would look better with whiskers, but perhaps more importantly, that if he did grow whiskers, that she could try and convince a few of her brothers who were holdouts to vote for the candidate.
I guess she also added that all the ladies like whiskers and they tease their husbands to vote for you and then you would be president. Did the president respond to the letter?
He did, in fact. He responded very promptly. He expressed some concern that perhaps his decision to grow whiskers would be seen as something of an affectation. But despite his reservations, apparently Lincoln decided to move forward, and shortly after the presidential election, he did, in fact, begin growing whiskers.
The beard caused quite a stir. I mean, I'm trying to imagine William Howard Taft, you know, losing 200 pounds between election time and inauguration time. They're looking at a wholly different candidate in their eyes.
Right. And, I mean, this is really quite a remarkable transformation. And, of course, most people, you know, this is obviously an era before television, so an awful lot of folks had not actually seen the president. They perhaps had seen images of him, you know, engravings or lithographs. But still, this was a remarkable transformation, and it effectively rendered obsolete a whole slew of campaign paraphernalia that trafficked in the image of the clean-shaved Lincoln.
I guess before knowing of this letter, many of Lincoln's biographers hypothesized on his reasons for growing the beard. Could you go over some of the speculation?
Well, oftentimes, this decision to grow whiskers has been described as an attempt to make Lincoln look older, to look more authoritative, to possess a certain kind of gravitas that perhaps he was lacking without the whiskers. And my interpretation is somewhat different, that in fact this was an effort to make him look more urbane, more sophisticated, more fashionable, and sort of cast off this this image of the frontier rail splitter.
Okay, so you just said during this, growing whiskers. Now, you make a distinction here and insist that Lincoln didn't actually have a beard. What do you mean?
Right, so this is actually the key distinction here. And contemporaries consistently described Lincoln's facial hair as whiskers. Now, this is a bit puzzling to us because we typically define a beard in terms of what I call facial real estate, you know, how much skin on the face is covered by the beard, right? And so the fact that Lincoln had facial hair that met under the chin, that covered the entirety of his lower face, that to us is what defines a beard. But in the 19th century, what really defined a beard and distinguished it from whiskers was not so much the facial real estate, but rather the length of the beard, the extent to which it was manicured or cultivated or restrained. And so the fact that Lincoln had short facial hair, even though it met underneath his chin, that was what connoted whiskers as opposed to a beard.
So was Lincoln self-conscious about being seen as a bit of a hick? I mean, I thought the backwoodsman was part of his brand.
Yeah, for sure. And it's this peculiar transformation because the image of the rail splitter clearly worked for Lincoln. I mean, it was such a successful campaign tactic. But, you know, we often find in American politics that the kinds of images and ideas that help candidates get elected are not necessarily the ideas and images that help them govern, right? And, you know, immediately following Lincoln's election, there's a radical transformation of the political context. You know, South Carolina and many of the other southern states begin to secede. And so I think that Lincoln really needs something different. He really needs to be a different kind of candidate, and that his facial hair helps him do this.
Not everyone was in favor of Lincoln's whiskers. In fact, what were the anti-whiskerists saying?
Well, some folks were critiquing Lincoln for sort of his pretension, you know, that here we are, the country is falling apart, and what are you doing? You're growing a beard. In the course of his travels from Springfield, Illinois, which is, of course, where he lived, to Washington, D.C., he stopped in Westfield, New York, which is where Grace Bedell, the young woman who wrote him, lived. And he had this sort of brilliant photo op where he stopped. He called her from the train. He stepped down. He gave her a kiss. So it was sort of this brilliant political spectacle. But of course, you know, at this particular moment, it was open to critique in the sense that, you know, it does not exactly convey seriousness in the way that one might like when the country is falling apart. But a lot of this was just sort of typical of the partisan press. You know, these were Democratic editors who would have found something to critique Lincoln on regardless.
The popularity of the beard is certainly back with millennials and artisanal pickle makers and the like. Will we see a beard on a president in the future, do you think, Sean?
You know, I think that's a very good question. The interesting thing is that these sort of fashionable whiskers that Lincoln was wearing, these really came into style in the late 1820s, early 1830s. And so it was really about 30 years before these became acceptable in the highest echelons of American political power. So, you know, obviously culture seems to change more quickly these days, and perhaps we don't have to wait 30 years before beards are acceptable on presidents, but I think it may still be some time before we see really high-ranking politicians wearing beards.
Sean Traynor, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Sean Traynor is a PhD candidate in history and women's studies at Penn State. He wrote the article, The Beard That Wasn't, Abe Lincoln's Whiskers, for theappendix.net. You can find the article along with some photos of Honest Abe in different stages of whisker growth. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, April is wasting away. That means just a week or so left of National Poetry Month. So just a few more days to keep those public radio haikus coming. Here's a recent example. Soft voice, deep wisdom. She is a vessel. God speaks through Krista Tippett. A reminder that haiku consists of three lines, five syllables in the first, seven in the middle, and the third line, five syllables again. Please share your haiku on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter, @wordofmouth. You'll also find a link to email us at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.